I'm Para Keehan, and this is Behind the Bench from AJP Hart & Cirque. After a year-long hiatus, Behind the Bench is back, listeners. Today, we're talking with Dewayne Townsend, corresponding author of the article Mechanisms of Reduced Myocardial Energetics of the Dystrophic Heart, published recently in AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. Trust me, you are going to love listening to Dewayne talk about science. I first met Dewayne when I invited him to be an expert on a podcast we produced a few months ago about another study published in AJP Heart and Circ. This one by Tim Domeyer and co-authors on calcium handling dysfunction and cardiac damage following acute ventricular preload challenge in the dystrophin deficient mouse heart. At one point, Dewayne vividly described exploding cells complete with sound effects and painted a picture of the beating mouse heart as an M&M, the chocolate-covered peanut variety, in case you're wondering. So when Dewayne and his co-authors published their recent study in our call for papers on molecular and cellular physiology of heart failure and cardiomyopathy, I jumped at the chance to find out more about his research and Dewayne himself. Please welcome back our esteemed co-hosts, Charlotte Usselman and Tommy Martin, who will get the story behind the story from the one and only Dewayne Townsend. Tommy?
Hi, Dewayne. Welcome to the show. Very excited to get into this work and this project with you. Yeah, I guess we can start off by just asking you maybe to briefly summarize the paper for us and what you guys found.
Yeah, that's kind of a big ask, right? So we're going to start at the beginning. I think that this is, we'll try to bring people along. So we study Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And so we like to think of Duchenne as being the most common of the rare diseases. So Duchenne muscular dystrophy is a genetic disease. It's results from the loss of the protein dystrophin. It was discovered in the 1860s, 1870s. So we've known about it for a really long time. But we didn't know what was causing it until like the 1980s or something like that. And so this disease, it's a bad disease. Dystrophin is on the X chromosome. So that means that it's X-linked. So it means it mostly affects boys. And so these kids, they get diagnosed when they're like 3 or 4, just as they're starting to go to school, preschool, and they're starting to interact with other kids, and their parents notice that they're just a little slow. You know, maybe they're not able to keep up, a little bit of weakness, this kind of thing. And they get, so they go to the neurologist and they get diagnosed. There's a blood test now that we do that will allow us to say, yeah, they have a mutation in your dystrophin gene. And once that comes out, once that diagnosis is made, this kid's life is kind of defined. And it's kind of a tragic life. So by the time they're 10, 12 years old, they're going to be in a wheelchair. They need help moving around. By the time they're 15, 16 years old, they're on a ventilator, right? Maybe a little older. And so that was kind of, for years, that's how these kids died. They would die of respiratory disease. They'd die of pneumonias and things like that. Over the last several decades, we've gotten really good at preventing them from dying from pneumonias. We've got really cool ventilators. The ventilator technology has really advanced. So now a lot of these kids have, they're adults by this time, have ventilators attached to their wheelchairs. And so they can breathe. These machines will breathe for them. We've gotten really good at managing airways. So we prevent pneumonias. And we have these cough assist device. You know, give a shout out to the cystic fibrosis field because they really pioneered a lot of the work being done on how do you prevent, you know, pulmonary disease. So the Duchenne kids have benefited from that because we've been able to treat them. And now we're finding that they're dying because their hearts are failing. Now, we knew their hearts were failing from the very beginning, from like the 1890s. You'd look at autopsies from these kids who had this mysterious X, well, they didn't know what the X chromosome was, but, you know, so they had this mysterious muscular dystrophy that affected mostly boys, and their hearts were just beat up, right? There was scar tissue everywhere. And so one thing we know, and even that we can measure it actually in vivo, right? You have these amazing cardiac imaging modalities that allow us to actually measure fibrosis in the heart. And what we see is that as these kids get older and older and older, there's just more and more scar tissue being replacing the cardiac myocytes. And so now you're losing heart muscle, you know? And so yeah, maybe it's no wonder that the heart muscle is failing. And so this is part of the dilemma we face. Okay, so here we are at the end. We've lost heart muscle, right? What can we do at that point? You know, I think one thing we've learned in the cardiac field over the last 20 some odd years is that the heart is really bad at regenerating. It just doesn't do it. And so these kids, as they're losing heart muscle, we're not going to get it back. So it really raises the question, how can we stop this from happening, right? And so the advantage, I guess, of dystrophin, little air quotes for those who, because it's radio, right? So pay attention. So you've got to figure out, so what's going on very early on. And so the advantage of Duchenne is that it's a genetic disease, which means that we know what's coming. And so we can predict the future, which is something that's usually pretty hard to do in medicine. And now we can do it, right? And actually, there's been a push. I want to give a shout out to Senator Klobuchar, Amy Klobuchar from our great state of Minnesota, who's been leading the charge on really improving funding for muscular dystrophy research. But she's also been pushing along to get newborn screening done. And so now, at least in Minnesota, Duchenne is one of the diseases that we look for early on. So we'll be able to know these kids at the time of birth whether they're going to face this challenge or not. Okay, so if we want to understand a disease before it's a disease, we got to figure out some way to model this or to figure it out. And so it turns out that Duchenne, as a disease that results from the absence of dystrophin, is not just a human thing. There are dog versions, there are cat versions, there are probably cow, horse, pig, every mammal type of versions, but usually we don't get to see them because they're just poor doers, as we would say in veterinary parlance. So they just never, we never really characterize them. But if it's your favorite golden retriever, then it gets worked up. And so, yeah, there's a whole line of dogs that are the golden retriever muscular dystrophy that have essentially a Duchenne phenotype. And it turns out that this happens in mice too. And so Jackson Labs, who's a big provider of various mouse strains, but they also do a lot of research. Back in the 80s, 1980s, before we even knew what dystrophin was, they found an X-linked muscular dystrophy. And they conveniently called this mouse the MD muscular dystrophy X mouse. So the MDX mouse, which is now a famous and maybe even some people have heard of it, mouse model that we use to try to understand muscular dystrophy. And this mouse is kind of an amazing little critter. It's a disease is really not as bad as human disease. And there's a very interesting sort of comparative story that we could go on, or at least I could go on. I don't know, maybe y'all couldn't stay with me, but you know, we work on it. And so this disease is pretty mild in the mouse. Of course, but the mouse has a pretty relaxed life, right? And they don't really have to do anything. They don't have to worry about predators. They don't have to worry, except for those animal technicians who come and move them every now and again, which freaks them out, and they kind of are a little stressed by that, but they get over it. But you know, their life's pretty chill. And so when we look at them, we say, you know, you guys don't look so sick. But if you push them a little bit, if you say, okay, little mouse, I'm going to put you on a treadmill, and I'm going to make that treadmill go downhill. And so when they're running downhill, it causes all kinds of stress and strain on their muscle, and they just can't do it. They just stop. They say, you know what? I'm going to sit on this grid back here that's really uncomfortable, but I'm not going to go on that treadmill anymore. And so there's disease under there. And we see it with the heart as well. And so we can take these mice and we give them a little injection of isobutyrenol, which is a drug that causes the heart to beat hard and fast for, a few hours. And then when we come back, like the next day, and we look at their hearts, they have just like 20% of their myocytes are necrotically injured, right? And so this is not a healthy heart, right? And so they have disease. And so we're trying to figure out, okay, we have this mouse model now that we can predict what's going to happen, right? They're going to develop disease a little later than what we would see. But if we push on them, we can make it really evident. And so maybe this would be useful to look at. And so folks started looking at the heart. One of the things that we see in heart failure, like just the regular old heart failure that people get all the time, is that they have a reduction in their myocardial energetics. We don't know why, how it happens. We don't know what's going on in heart failure. We just see this observation that their phosphocreatine, which is I kind of think of it as a battery charge, level. If you have lots of phosphocreatine, you're in good shape. If you have low phosphocreatine, you have less energy. And so their phosphocreatine is low in people with heart failure. So we thought, oh, that's interesting. So back in the day, they used to do this thing where they would take an NMR. So maybe you remember NMR from organic chemistry, right? You'd measure, put your sample in there, and you'd hopefully get something interesting out of it. And they would put a whole freaking heart down inside this magnet, down inside an NMR. And then they would have the heart do stuff. And then so it turns out that, in organic, we end up talking a lot about proton NMR and things like that. But they were measuring phosphate. So phosphate is also a paramagnetic nuclei, and so it has the ability to interact with the NMR magnetic field. And so you can measure things like, ATP. You can measure phosphocreatine. You can measure all kinds of stuff. And so people would put hearts down inside these magnets. And so someone did that with one of these MDX hearts, and they saw that there was a deficiency. And so we thought, huh. That's kind of interesting, but it's a heart outside the mouse, inside a magnet. Maybe there's something else going on there. And so we weren't really sure that this is a thing. So then we kind of continue to watch the literature and kind of see what are the things that other people have coming up. And so we talk a little bit about Duchenne being X-linked, right? And how it affects mostly males. But it turns out that females have X chromosomes too. Surprise, surprise, right? And when you have a broken dystrophin on one X chromosome and a normal other X chromosome, you don't get Duchenne, but you are a carrier and you do get disease. You're actually more susceptible to heart disease than just a normal average run-of-the-mill person. And so there was some interest in understanding what's going on with these people. And so someone did. So you can take this same NMR type technology is what we use for MRI and things like that. And when you're not using it for protons, we actually call it magnetic resonance spectroscopy, so MRS. And so what you can do with this is you can find parts of your body that you want to pay attention to, and you can measure the phosphate in the body of the muscle, right? The resolution is pretty crappy. It's like, I don't know, maybe the size of a golf ball, but you can kind of see there's a heart somewhere in that golf ball space, and you can decide, well, what's the phosphate doing in that? And they found that these carriers, so carriers are interesting because they express dystrophin in half of their cardiac myocytes. So they'll have dystrophin negative right next to regular dystrophin replete myocytes. And so when we look at these hearts, we have a golf ball sized voxel, we call them when we're measuring, and we look at where the heart should be, and we see that there's a reduction in their phosphocreatine ATP ratio. Now, this is interesting, right? Because now we've got this person, right, who's got dystrophin, and they have energetic deficiencies too now. So this is kind of curious. Long story short, we got involved in this. We had a colleague who was so here at the University of Minnesota, we have the Center for Magnetic Resonance Research, and so one of the things we have is fair number of reasonably high field magnets. And so one of our colleagues was working on this, and they had the the idea that they wanted to do this in the mouse and see what's going on in the MDX mouse. And so they did the same thing with a high field magnet. Instead of like a golf ball, we're kind of looking at maybe a marble. So we kind of put that marble voxel kind of in the middle of the mouse's chest, and we try to say, well, what's the phosphate in here? And lo and behold, these mice, they too had a reduction in their phosphocreatine ATP ratio. Okay. So now energetics is a thing. And reduced energetics is a thing in these dystrophic hearts. I think we can say that now with reasonable confidence. And so we had been studying dystrophic cardiomyopathies, trying to understand sort of the physiology of it for a while before this. And one of the things that we had kind of looked at was, obviously, we're talking energetics. Who makes the energy, right? The mitochondria, right? The powerhouse of the cell. And so we wanted to know, is this powerhouse okay? What's going on? And so we took some of these MDX hearts. You know, these mice, you look at their hearts, you would be hard-pressed to say that's an MDX heart versus a control heart, right? These are young, relatively young mice. And so they don't have a lot of disease that's super evident. And so we did a EM electron micrograph. So we take the hearts out and we fix them and we slice them super thin and we fuse them with uranium and all kinds of crazy metals to let electrons not go through or go through in different capabilities. And this allows us to look at inside the cells. And so we can see inside the cells and we can see where the nuclei are. We can see where the sarcomeres, for those who are wondering, are the contractile elements that make your heart beat. And so you've got to have, so you can see all these parts, and you can see the mitochondria, right? And you can see inside the mitochondria. So mitochondria are these really complex things, and they have an outer membrane and an inner membrane, and then they have an inside the inner membrane, which we call the matrix. And in the matrix is where the magic happens, the Krebs cycle. Maybe you remember the Krebs cycle from early biology, where you're like, maybe you even had to memorize that dastardly thing, right? And so then you have this is all happening inside these mitochondria, inside these cells that are getting the ATP, that are producing the ability of your heart to beat. Okay, so we look at these mitochondria and we say, they don't look so bad. They look pretty normal, in fact. And then we ask, well, how many of them are there? And so we did all this imaging and this calculations, and we figure out, and they have about the same number too. So then we're like, well, maybe there's something wrong with their function. Maybe they're broken. And so we isolated cells. We took these hearts and we digest them and we isolate these cells and we put them in this fancy machine. They call it a seahorse machine. Marketing, you know, but what it does is it measures the oxygen consumption of individual cells. And so these individual cells are just, well, okay, these are myocytes, and they're kind of like Ferraris as far as cells go, right? They really want to go burn, but they're just in a dish, right? And so they're sort of idling, right? And so we're measuring how much is this work, how much is this, these myocytes consuming oxygen while they're just, you know, idling along. And, you know, it was a little bit lower, but it wasn't like dramatically lower. And so we're like, okay. And so then you can do this thing with mitochondria where you kind of, it's kind of like going back to our Ferrari, right? So you put it out of gear and then you just jam on the gas and then you can really fly. And so we do this with a drug called FCCP. And so FCCP uncouples the mitochondrial membrane potential. And so now the mitochondria is just like, let's go. And they just burn through oxygen. And so we thought, well, if there's going to be a deficit, we're going to see it here, right? Because if the oxygen consumption is broken, no, they are perfectly normal, right? So now we're like, geez, what the heck's going on here, right? And so we go to some others working on the same problem. They actually took the cell. So you take these hearts and you can grind them up, and then you can isolate the mitochondria, right? And so you find a little fraction, or you spin them this way, that way, all this kind of stuff. And you can get a bunch of mitochondria in one spot at one time, and you can measure their oxygen consumption. Maybe our cell process was broken, these types of things. And so then they measured the oxygen consumption and it was normal. So here we are. We know that there's poor energetics. We know that the mitochondria should be able to make energy, but they're not. What the heck? All right. So this was confusing. I was like, I don't know where to go with this. So I was at a Gordon conference, and so I don't know if you're familiar with Gordon conferences, but they have a they're kind of small conferences that bring people together that are focused on a specific field. And so this was a I'm gonna flub the actual name, but it's a cardiac regulation type meeting, right? These meetings, of course, they have poster sessions where folks are presenting their stuff. And so I was going to the poster session as one does. And I came across this postdoc, Dr. Sarah Glancy, who was a postdoc in Dr. MacKay's lab at George Washington University. And she had done this really cool project where it was looking at perfluorocarbons. It was very neat, and I was really improving oxygenation of the tissues, and I thought it was really cool. And now I was like, I got this problem. Here's this person that knows a lot about mitochondria. I'm like, hey, I got a problem for you. Help me solve it, right? And so we sat down, and I was like, here's the thing. So I just explained everything that we just talked about, and she's like, that's a really interesting question, right? Because you have this deficit that is only present when the mitochondria are actually loaded, doing work, and all of this. So you have to kind of go back and say, well, maybe we have to look at the mitochondrial function in the heart.
Dwayne, can I just pop in on that point?
Yeah,
I
of
think
course.
it's interesting that you reach this kind of difficulty with your model and the inability to model probably what's happening in the actual heart, right? How much of a hurdle was that for you? Like, how long did it take before you, I don't know, came across this poster and then thought, you know what, this is the answer. The whole time I've had this model, I think there's a phenotype, but I can't catch it because I'm working in a dish and not in an intact heart,
Yeah,
right? Or in a heart
no,
that's just sitting in a dish.
that's a really great question, and too long is the answer. And so it's one of those things where you're just plugging away, you're trying to figure out what's going on. We had done a whole series of studies where we were looking at the effect of ischemia, hypoxia, all of these things. And we kind of narrowed it down. We thought that hypoxia might be an issue, but because they, when we, when, you know, it was a little bit backwards how we ended up in this. So the first thing we showed is that when you take a dystrophic heart and you put it on a Langendorf preparation. So for those who don't know, a Langendorf is like, it's like a zombie heart, right? So you're going to take the mouse, you're going to sack the mouse, you're going to take the mouse's heart out, and then you're going to put it on this little device that's going to keep the mouse heart alive after the mouse is dead. So this heart's beating away really quite quickly, as we've discussed previously. And so you can measure the function of this heart. And so we had shown that if you turn the flow off to this heart for even just a little bit, and then turn it back on, that heart just doesn't recover very well. And so we thought, huh, that's an interesting observation. It's not hugely clinically relevant. I mean, if kids were getting heart attacks, yeah, maybe it would be a thing, but Duchenne kids don't get heart attacks. And so it was kind of like sort of an odd observation. But then we went back and we said, well, what if we make them acidotic, right? And so when you make when you cause ischemia, you cause two things. One is oxygen goes away, and the other is that you get a buildup of metabolic byproducts, and that generally tends to lower the pH, which can be really bad for the heart contracting. And so we went back and we said, well, let's see what happens if we make them acidic. And so we would lower the pH of the solution around the heart, and we showed that, the dystrophic heart didn't mind that so much, right? And so that kind of got us thinking, well, maybe hypoxia is our problem. But that still didn't help us, because we're like, oh, we don't even know how to measure hypoxia in this. And so that's really what got me stopping at Sarah's poster, was I'm curious about hypoxia. But then she was like telling me all about the mitochondria, the action. And I was like, wait a second, you know a lot about mitochondria. I need to learn from you. And so I followed her around a little bit, and then we ended up talking to Matt K, Dr. K, about this whole thing. And it turns out they introduced me to a new technique that had been kind of developed working at NIH in Bob Balaban's lab. And so in Bob's lab, they've been studying for a long time the ability to look literally look into the heart with visible light and make physiological measurements and understand what's happening. And so if you shine a light onto a heart or through a heart, right, it's not clear, right? There's things that absorb that light. And the color of those lights, the color of that absorption spectra is dependent on the redox state of the variety of things inside this heart. So in reality, what this allows you to do is you have in this spectra, hidden in this information, you have the ability to look at things like myoglobin. You can say how much oxygen is on this myoglobin versus that myoglobin. You can say you have this built-in oxygen sensor, which is, wait a second, that could be really useful. And so then not only that, but wait, there's more, right? You get the electron transport chain. That's where the other cytochromes, we call them, because they're cell and their color, right? Cytochrome. And so these cytochromes that live in the electron transport chain, you can look at a couple of those and you can learn things like what the membrane potential might be doing, where the electrons are. We are following electrons in beating hearts. Ah,
By
holy buckets,
shining a
how
light
cool is
on the
that,
heart.
right? And so you're like, whoa, this would really be neat. We should really figure out how to do this. And so that started us on a journey. So Dr. Matt is like, what do I need to do this? And he's like, well, first you need a $15,000 spectrometer, and then you need all these LEDs. And so, okay. So I write a grant. I said to the MDA, we got to do this. And the MDA is like, okay, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do it. And so they're like, okay, so we get some money from MDA. We had a little bit of money from NIH. Of course, this is all, everybody out there should know that almost everything we do is dependent upon NIH federal funding. So please contact your representatives and make sure that they are funding NIH research. Okay, little side note. All right, so where were we? Oh, we were back. We got our spectrometer. We got our lights. We had our Langendorf. And so then we were sort of figuring out how we were going to do this. And so we got our 3D printer out and we made these little cuvettes that we could put the hearts into and still hold them and still not make a huge mess. And so then we're able to shine light through the heart. Okay, so then we get this spectra and we're collecting these spectra, by the way, every 10 milliseconds. Okay, we're doing this for like 40 minutes, and you can do the math. You end up with a lot of data. And we're like, how are we going to analyze all this data? And so we get this spectra. Okay. And so we're like, okay, what's next? So then we have to deconvolute the spectra. And so what we have is Bob Balaban's group. They sent us a little Excel file. And in this Excel file, it had these things called reference spectra. And what this is someone went and they isolated myoglobin and they took a spectra of it. And then they would add a bunch of oxygen and then they would take a spectra of it. So you have deoxymyoglobin, you have oxymyoglobin, you can reduce it. So you could, well, actually, it's oxidizing, right? So you oxidize that, you get metmyoglobin, right? And so then you can look at that spectra. Interestingly, we see very little metmyoglobin in the heart ever. I don't think I've tried to introduce it and I just can't see it. But if you want to see your hamburger, right, you burn your cook your steak, right? That brown, that's your metmyoglobin right there. So metmyoglobin's tasty, but it doesn't show up in the heart. All right, so we've got these spectra. I should say we also have spectra for all the cytochromes, all the electron transport cytochromes. Now those are a little trickier, and we can kind of go back to them, but let's just stay for the moment, right? So we've got these spectra that are really just a big long list of numbers, right? And so we have to somehow take these spectra and fit them to the spectra that we get as we come through the heart. And so now we have to go back, break out my linear algebra textbook, and try to figure out how on earth are we going to do this, right? And I have to give a special shout out to all the developers out on Stack Overflow. Thank you for answering random questions about linear algebra online. You never know when it's going to help out. You helped this little dystrophy researcher figure out how on earth are we going to be able to fit these hundreds of thousands of files, spectra, verse of data to understand what is happening to each of these different cytochromes. And so the long story short is that you take your original spectra and then you can multiply your reference spectrum by a constant and you can get a pretty good approximation of what you're seeing. And so then you can say, well, okay, so now we can start looking at stuff. All right. So here we are. We've got our dystrophic heart. We're shining a light through it. We can kind of see what's going on. And our big question is the hypoxia hypothesis, right? Is there evidence that the dystrophic heart is hypoxic? Now, this wasn't just a crazy idea. There was a lot of actually information in skeletal muscle that suggested this might be the case. So dystrophin, you might remember, this poor protein that is now gone in our Duchenne patients, has an important role. It appears to do a lot of things, but one of the things is it does is it would keep in skeletal muscle, it keeps nitric oxide synthase at the membrane. So nitric oxide synthase, you might remember, or you might even guess, is the enzyme that creates nitric oxide. And it does this in a calcium dependent manner, right? So if I'm a little muscle cell, and so muscle cells, every time they contract, calcium goes up. And every time they relax, goes down. Calcium goes up, down, up, down, up, every time it's contracting. And so if I'm a muscle cell and I'm contracting, I've got a lot of calcium kind of flying around. And then my nitric oxide synthase, which is calcium dependent, when you increase calcium, you increase nitric oxide production. So these little muscle cells that are contracting are also sort of have this cloud of nitric oxide around them. And so that works out really handy for them because it turns out that vessels who control blood flow, they like to respond to nitric oxide by saying, whoa, let's just relax and chill, right? Letting more blood flow come in. So this is a really cool system, right? Because the muscle that's contracting gets the blood. How convenient, right? That's exactly what we want. So, does this happen in the heart? This is a conundrum to determine. We don't really know. Coronary regulation is super complicated. As you might imagine, it is very redundant. Coronary flow is kind of important for the evolutionary survival of the organism. And so, there are multiple pathways. Nitric oxide probably plays a role. How important is it? We didn't know, but we thought, well, heck, if we're breaking all of these parts, maybe there's a thing here. So we were curious about the hypoxia hypothesis. And so one of the things we did is we take our hearts and we shine light through them, and we collect a spectrum. And then we make the mouse hypoxic. So how do we make them? Well, you remember this is Langendorf, right? Now we control everything this heart sees. And so normally we're trying to give them as much oxygen as we possibly can. And so we're bubbling in like 95% oxygen. And then we've got tubes that seal everything. And we try to keep as much oxygen available to that heart as possible. As I tell my respiratory physiology students, dissolved oxygen is really not that important in your body, right? Because we have all these beautiful things called red blood cells that take the oxygen and really, but here we are in our Langendorf, we have no red blood cells. So we're really trying to just tilt the oxygen, right? We get pour as much oxygen in as we can. And then so if we want to make them hypoxic, we just take that oxygen away, we replace it with nitrogen, and we see what happens, right? And so we can take away a ton of oxygen. So we can see what hypoxia should look like. And then we can look at what normal hearts are looking like. And then we also did a series of studies where we would infuse dobutamine. So dobutamine is another one of those drugs that really activates the heart and tells it to beat hard and fast and go, 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 go. And so we had these three groups, okay? So we got our control group, we have our dobutamine group, which is the one that's working really hard. And then we have our hypoxic group, which is the one that just doesn't have oxygen.
Before you move on to your findings, I wanted to ask a naive question about where does chloroform come into all of these measures? Because as I was reading your methods, I was like, don't understand that, don't understand that, don't understand that, until I got to the frozen hearts were pulverized and homogenized and methanol and extraction separated with chloroform methanol mixture. So that's a word I know. What are you doing with the chloroform?
Dun dun dun. Okay,
What are you doing to
so
these mice, Dwayne?
we have been focused so much on the beauty of spectroscopy in the heart that we neglected to discuss the metabolomic component of this study. And so we'll go there because you asked, right? And so one of the things we were curious about, so you remember you might recall, that we were doing this spectroscopy, the MRS, right? Where we could measure like the golf ball or the marble-sized voxel inside the little mouse's heart, and we knew that phosphocreatine was a little bit low, ATP was not behaving, and all of these things. Okay, but that's, we're measuring in the little marble space. So what, and we can only measure phosphocreatine, ATP. We can measure ADP a little bit. We can take a guess at AMP, these types of things. But if there's not a lot of it and it doesn't have a lot of phosphate, then we're not going to see it. And so we were curious, well, we want to know more about what's going on with the metabolites. And so we kind of left the story, another whole paper where we went through and we said, well, let's figure out if we can define a way to measure more metabolites in these hearts. And so we have a so we take our Langendorf, we're measuring our function, and then while that heart's beating away, doing its own little thing, we freeze it. And so we freeze it super fast and super cold, right? And so we freeze it so fast, it's liquid nitrogen isn't cold enough for what we want to do. Right. And so we put it in liquid nitrogen. If you put it in liquid nitrogen, you put anything warm in liquid nitrogen. If you put your finger in liquid nitrogen, which I do not recommend, right? What's going to happen is that you get a little, as soon as you put it in, all that liquid turns to a gas, right? And then that gas is like a little sock that sits over your finger or your heart or your mouse heart that you're putting inside there, right? And so it doesn't get cold anymore because it's like a that's a little pillow of air around it. And so that's not good for us because we need to freeze it fast, right? Because ATP consumption in the heart, oh my goodness, it is so fast. We did some studies where we're like, oh, we're pretty fast at taking hearts out. And so we would do it and we would take them out, 15 seconds from a mouse being alive to a heart frozen. It's too slow. All the phosphocreatine was gone. ATP was like really low. And so we're like, okay, that's not going to work. So that's why we went to the Langendorf. Okay. So now we're on the Langendorf. So the heart's beating along. We freeze it. Bang. Okay. So now it's frozen. Yay. Right. Okay. But now we got to get the metabolites out. But we have to get the metabolites out without reactivating metabolism. And so the way we do that is we take these hearts, still frozen. We have this thing called the pulverizer. And what the pulverizer is it's a stainless steel dish, and it's got a little insert in it, and then it's got this piston. And then we have this hammer. It's called the dead blow. It says it right on the handle, the dead blow. It's a 1 kilogram handle. And then you're like, okay, fire in the hole, boom, and you bang this thing. You have to do that because people are like pipetting super cautiously. You got like 2 microliters across the way, and then people are like, ah. So you've got to be careful, right? And so we're bang. And so we turn this heart that was, this beating entity frozen, we turn it to dust. Okay. So now we've got this cardiac dust, which is in the bottom of our dish, still super cold, which is how it has to be, right? Because if it warmed up, it would start using ATP. And then it's like, what's the point here, right? And so it's still frozen. Okay. So how can we warm it up? Because we can't do everything at liquid nitrogen temperatures, but prevent things from digesting. Well, that's where methanol and chloroform come in handy, right? Because if there's anything that that biology doesn't like, it's methanol and chloroform, right? Because that breaks everything. It turns your proteins inside out. It breaks your lipids, all the things. And so that's what the methanol chloroform was for. Okay, so we do our little methanol chloroform digestion. And so what's really cool is then all of the polar metabolites will like hang out in the methanol, and all the lipid soluble metabolites will hang out in the chloroform, and you can separate them, and then you can take the methanol out and you could take the chloroform out. And then we take under nitrogen, we get the nitrogen tank and we're blowing, we can evaporate the methanol, and then we leave the slightly yellow golden material that is the heart and soul of the metabolome of the myocyte. So now we need to figure out what the heck is in this mess, right? So now we've got our tube that has our dried down metabolites. And so we take that and we resuspend that in a, I'm going to call it the NMR buffer because that's what we call it. It's basically a phosphate buffer. So then we go back. We have here at the University of Minnesota, we have the Minnesota Magnetic Resonance Center. This is an amazing facility. It has We've got like seven, eight huge spectrometers, like 17 foot tall spectrometers. And so you have these huge spectrometers, and so you go up, you take your sample, you put them in, you might remember from organic, those very thin glass tubes, and so thank God they have an auto sampler there, because you can basically just put your stuff in a rack and you press a few buttons, doo, 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 and then it just the robot takes over, and it will grab and it'll take your tube and it'll put it in the spectrometer, then whoosh, down into the magnet it sits, and then down there it starts measuring proton NMR, looking at what's in here. And so then it scans it once, scans it twice, scans it 30 times, and then you get a really nice image of all of the metabolites. And so when you look at it, you're like, oh my goodness, this makes no sense. But fortunately, it turns out that there are programs out there. So we use a program called Kinomics, which has a library of NMR spectra. And so from the NMR spectra, you can then go and you can measure individual metabolites.
Can I chime in on that point? Like,
Yeah.
obviously, you find in this study a couple of metabolites that are different, which leads you to like say like energetics in the DMD heart is, you know, quite distinct from the wild type, and that could underlie, obviously, the be a cause of the disease, and you know, leads to disease, potentially also being, you know, a target to prevent the disease. Because obviously, when you have the fibrotic heart, you know, it's probably too late. Like you mentioned before, you don't really have this cardiac regeneration is not exactly a thing yet, and maybe never will be. So if you could pick just one thing that you think would be the therapeutic target for preventing or slowing disease progression of this paper, what do you think, if you were a betting man, you would put your money on?
You ask difficult questions, my friend. So it is hard to say at this point. And so the dilemma we have is that we haven't finished our story. So I can't really jump to my end. Like I'm going to say, we need to fix this because this is broken, because you don't know what's broken yet. We're getting there. I promise. We're getting there. I'll speed it up, right? All right, so here we are. So we've got our metabolites. We can measure all the metabolites, and we can measure things like ATP. We can measure things like phosphocreatine. And we do that. We do that in our dystrophic hearts. And we find, oh my goodness, ATP is a little bit low, which is kind of shocking because ATP is supposed to be defended. There's supposed to not be an issue, but it's low. Phosphocreatine is low, right? So it suggests, again, consistent with this idea that energetics is a problem in these hearts, which we kind of knew. We kind of were pretty confident of that. But now we've got another method just showing us that this is broken. We see it at baseline. We see it when we push these hearts, the dobutamine hearts, who are beating really hard. We're seeing reductions in their energetics and all of these things. So we've got this problem. We were asking the hypoxia hypothesis is where we were back to this story, right? Before our metabolic divergence there, right? And so we get back to our hypoxia question. So we're wondering, are they hypoxic? Are they just not delivering oxygen? Because that would explain a lot, wouldn't it? If they just didn't have oxygen getting there, we could say, oh, that's why they're not making ATP. Then we can really focus on fixing the vasculature and this kind of thing. And so we do that and we look and we say, okay, if we make them hypoxic, what do we expect to see? Well, the first thing we expect to see is myoglobin. So myoglobin is this amazing little protein that binds to oxygen. Myocytes are chock full of them. And we really don't know what it's doing. So in like whales and seals, we really have a pretty good idea. They're like oxygen batteries, right? But in people and in mice, we're like, okay, maybe it helps with oxygen transport, this kind of thing. But then they made a mouse that didn't have myoglobin, and we thought, oh, this mouse is going to be so dead. No, this mouse was so fine. It's like, what the hell? You're just normal. And so, you could push it and you could make it break if you really wanted to, but you're like, this was a protein we thought was going to be critical to everything, and it's not meaning anything when it's gone. Really points to the resiliency of physiology, right? Is you can take out things you think are really important, and it's like, whatever, I can still handle it.
And that points to the redundancies that you're talking about in the heart then too, right? That the heart is built for that kind of thing, that you can remove something critical and it's still firing.
Right. And that's, evolution is crazy, right? And so here we are. So we're looking, okay, we've got this oxygen sensor inside the heart, which is pretty handy. I mean, if myoglobin's good for anything, it's good for sensing oxygen inside the heart, right? And so normally myoglobin, your myoglobin in your heart right now is really saturated because it has pretty high oxygen affinity, and it's like, I'm going to bind oxygen. Like it'll steal it from hemoglobin all the time. And so then you've got, so normally your myoglobin's really super saturated, but remember, these hearts are Langendorf hearts, and they are not perfused with blood. They're perfused with liquid that has as much oxygen stuffed in it as you could possibly have. And they are a little hypoxic because they're like, So their myoglobin is only like 60, 70% saturated. Okay, so we see that at baseline. And we thought, huh, okay. So when we make them hypoxic, perhaps not surprisingly, we see a reduction in our myoglobin saturation. So we can make them very, we lower their myoglobin saturation. And so from this, we can actually measure and calculate what the oxygen concentration is inside the cell of a beating heart. You know, so it's like, geez. Okay, so then we do a dobutamine. So myoglobin's fine. We're like, geez. Okay, so maybe they're not hypoxic. So we go at it a different way. We go and we get one of these myoglobin knockout mice, and we say, okay, this mouse doesn't have myoglobin, so it's really going to be broken. And we've crossed it on the MDX, and is like, whatever, I'm fine. I'm just as bad as the MDX, but I'm no better. I'm no worse. And so I was like, okay. But we threw it up on the Langendorf, and we did the spectroscopy. So it's kind of like if you've ever done spectroscopy, right? You've got your blank, your control that you do ahead of time, and then you add your sample that you're going to look at. Well, here we have a blank, which has just the cytochromes, right? The myoglobin's gone. And so we can then subtract that out, and we can look at the myoglobin. And so that's another way we looked at the myoglobin. And again, we see there's no evidence of hypoxia. We go and we look at the metabolites. So things that you might expect would change with if you were running out of oxygen, running out of energy, and we look at the energetics. So we in hypoxia, we see huge increases in AMP, which we would expect, right? Because ATP gets converted to ADP, and then there's this adenylate kinase, another backup mechanism that can turn two ADPs back into ATP and an AMP, and it's sort of a rescue mechanism to say, hey, I need more energy, get me more ATP. But then you get a buildup of AMP, which does a whole bunch of other cool things, but we're not going to talk about because there's only so much time in the day. And so then you've got ATP building up. Okay, then we're like, okay, what else might we see? And so in this metabolomics, you know, we got this big complex NMR spectra. We can pull out like a couple dozen different metabolites that both are at high concentration and have a convenient spectral signature so that we can find them easily. So we can measure things like succinate and fumarate, and now you're getting Krebs cycle trauma again, right? But these are metabolites within the Krebs cycle that build up when oxygen is deficient. And so we see evidence and we see increases in the presence of these metabolites that you would expect to see when there's not enough oxygen. We know what hypoxia looks like, and we're not seeing it. We're not seeing it at rest. We're not seeing it even when we push these hearts really hard. So it's like, so maybe it's not hypoxia. And so we move on to the next question. So the next thing is, well, we've got this electron transport chain. Maybe there's something amiss here. Maybe it's just not making ATP.
Can I point out something here that I think is kind of critical for, especially like trainees who maybe it's their first paper or study, and you get all this, you know, what you would call negative data, right? Everything you're coming across is like, okay, it's not this. We think it's hypoxia, but then we have no phenotype. We keep pushing and pushing, and we look at metabolites, and we're still getting nothing. Could you speak to the persistence that is required in science, and you know how it doesn't really always work out every time you have an idea? In fact, it's almost the total opposite, right? You know, for a lot of trainees, including myself, and certainly in graduate students, it can be the hardest part of becoming a scientist is accepting that like you're probably going to be wrong most of the time. Can you speak to that a little bit?
It is a slog. Some of this data we first picked up, you know, some of that early hypoxia signature stuff was like right when my lab started, like 2010. It was like really old data. It's like, you know, so we're finally publishing it now. And so it takes a long time. And there's just a lot of patience, a lot of perseverance, as you say, right? Is that you're things are not going to work. And even when they work, sometimes they don't work, right? So this whole spectroscopy thing, I mean, it was kind of just like a big shot in the dark. Are we going to see something? I don't know. Let's look. And so, you know, we try and we do what we can. And that's, you know, a huge part of science is just keeping going. You know, I think that that's probably the number one personality trait of successful scientists or scientists who are still in the game is that they stay in the game, right? They just keep going. They try to find a way, try to figure out, you know, I'm going to talk to this guy. I'm going to talk to that person. I'm going to talk to her about these things, just trying to figure out how can we make sense of this, you know, in this. So the Duchenne field is kind of an interesting one because you're studying heart failure or diabetes. I mean, there's millions of people out there that have this, and you're kind of like, oh, you never really get to meet them very well. But here, at least at Minnesota, we have a pretty strong clinical muscular dystrophy center, and so we have these events where we get to meet patients, you get to meet these kids, and kind of see where they are. And in part of your mind, you're like, I know where you're headed, and I know what's going on a molecular level inside your muscle. But in another part of your mind, you're like, dude, you like Minecraft just like my kid. Right. And so it's like, what are you going to do? You're going to give up on that? No, you just keep going. You keep trying to find a way to help out and do something that's going to sort of push the needle. And so that's something we've been really trying to get our head around. How can we understand from, this molecular studies to understand how this disease is progressing? And so we sort of push on, right? So we had this hypoxia, we had this beautiful hypothesis, another beautiful hypothesis slain by data, right? And that's the beauty and the tragedy of science, right? Is you come up, you spend all this time developing this beautiful notion, this idea that no one has ever had in the history of humanity. And then you go and you test that hypothesis more rigorously than anybody else in the entire world has ever even thought about testing that hypothesis. And then you show that that hypothesis that you spent hours, months, years sort of cogitating over is totally wrong. And you're like, oh, dang. All right. Well, that would have been handy, but moving on, right? So you move to the next thing. And so our next thing was, well, let's look at this electron transport chain. And so the electron transport chain is really kind of tricky. Cytochromes, we're not looking at pure cytochromes. We're looking at a cytochrome that has an electron and a cytochrome that doesn't have an electron. And we're really interested in the difference between those two. And so then you could sort of follow along in the paper, but we sort of transition. So when we're doing the myoglobin, we're looking at like raw absorbance. And then when we do the cytochromes from the electron transport chain, we switch to a different spectra approach. And so that different spectra allows us to really tease out some of these fine differences in the populations of these cytochromes. And so again, we're looking at the whole heart, which is beating 420 times a minute, creating a pressure gradient of 100 and some odd millimeters of mercury. And so it's doing this heart thing, and we're taking pictures of the electrons in its electron transport chain to say, where are you? So we look at all of their spectra. We look at what is this state of complex four. So this required us to go back to some of the structural biology, which actually was just published like last year, which is kind of handy. And so then we were able to fit, and you can identify, oh, here is the complex four that doesn't have oxygen. Here's complex four that has oxygen, but no electrons. Here's complex four that has oxygen in one electron. And then okay, to be fair, we can't really tell oxygen with no electrons away from oxygen with two electrons. They're too close spectrally. But I mean, geez, in a beating heart. Did I mention that? Did I mention this is in a beating heart? Getting to the story, right? The punchline, as it were. So we're looking through these complex fours, and we're finding what we find is that, but the complex four gets stuck in a certain spot, right? And it's like this electron wants to come in, it gets one electron, but it doesn't get a second. It has to wait for the second. So it's building up in that space. And so that's kind of a curious thing as we're trying to understand, what the hell does it mean? You take dystrophin away, a protein that is sitting on the plasma membrane, and the phenotype we see is this poor electron transport into complex four. And so, yeah, okay. So maybe this helps understand what's going on with the energetics of the heart, right? There's some deficiency in the electron transport chain of the dystrophic heart. What's causing that? Well, for that, we'd need another podcast. And so we're trying to figure out what's going on with this. And so we have a grant that really focuses on a couple of hypotheses that we have about what's going on. And hopefully we can then come back in a few years and we can kind of tell you, here's the answer. We solved the problem. Yeah, but if past performance is any indication of future performance, we'll find that it's just super more complicated and we'll have much more to work on. But that's how it goes.
So, Dwayne, the thought that I kept on thinking, you are a DVM. So, if I'm correct, you've got your doctorate of veterinary medicine. So, how do you go from And maybe, I don't know if you're planning on studying or on helping golden retrievers, as you mentioned earlier, but how does one get from being a DVM to studying Duchenne muscular dystrophy?
I graduated from undergrad and I was like, you know what? I want to do comparative medicine. I want to understand how disease manifests and different species and different things like that. And so then I got to vet school and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. And then winter break here, we got like a month off and I'm like, what the hell am I going to do? And so I went to my biochemist for a friend and said, hey, you got like anything I can do? Like just help out in the lab or something. And so then I got put on this project. It was a horse. Equine muscle disease. And so these horses, they have this random polysaccharide storage myopathy. And so my job was, well, in humans, we look at humans because we're trying to figure this out. Sometimes they get crazy polysaccharide inclusions when you have a deficit in glycolysis. Okay. So my job over that winter break and then into the summer was you're going to measure the activity of every single glycolytic enzyme, and you're going to measure the activity of the regulation of phosphofructokinase and phosphofructokinase 2, as you might remember from your glycolysis days. And so then, so that was my job. I went and measured all these enzymes and went through, and you know what? I found no differences. There was nothing wrong with their glycolytic enzymes. But what was really cool is this was like my highly cited paper for the longest time because it had all the methods for measuring all the enzymes of glycolysis. So if anybody wanted to measure the activity of pyruvate kinase in muscle, they'd go to my paper and they'd say, hey, there it is. And so that was kind of fun. So to cut that story short, it turns out that they have a deficit in their branching enzyme. And so their little branching enzyme can't keep up with the glycogen synthase. So the glycogen synthase just goes, creates these really long chains. Which are pretty useless when glycogen's supposed to be like a bush, right? And they're supposed to come down from all the sides, release a bunch of glucose, and then life is good. But these guys would have all these glycogen, it was just this long single strand. And so when it was time to release the glycogen, they could just do a little bit at a time. And so that was not good. And then their muscle would be like, hey, I was expecting all this glucose and I got nothing. And now I got no ATP. And then my membranes just blow and then all hell breaks loose. And so we come up with different tricks. We put them on a high fat diet so they're not relying on carbohydrates very much. But probably most importantly, we came up with a genetic test. So then you can identify these horses should not be breeding. Let's get rid of this thing. But that got me really interested in, kind of this interface between muscle disease, and this sort of thing. It turns out they had an MD, or sorry, a DVM PhD program. And so, as part of the, at least at the time, they would pay for your entire vet school. I was like, oh, I'm all for that, right? I get to do research. You're going to pay me to do research, and you're going to pay for vet school. I was like, sold. Right. And so then I entered the PhD program. I actually studied neurobiology in my PhD. So I had a minor in neuroscience and all that's come in handy various times. Studied G protein, studied opioid receptors, G protein coupled receptors, really trying to understand sort of the mechanisms. And so it was a good training in how to do science, how to think about data and all these things. But then when I went back to the clinic, I was like thinking, what do I want to do? Where do I want to go? Do I want to go into veterinary medicine? Do I want to go into research? What do I want to do? And so then I had our cardiology rotation. And I was like, oh, this heart is so freaking amazing. Look at all this stuff it does. Right. And so you're like, oh, this is cool. This is very. And so the lead mentor, the cardiologist there, was really into basic science research. And so we were talking about, the sarcomere and how calcium regulation and the cardiac development and all this stuff. And I was like, oh, this is really neat. And so then as I'm sort of approaching the end, I'm like, how do I want to mix this up? Right. And so one thing I was always a little bit curious about is how do we make sense of all of this? Right. And so one way we do that when we're trying to understand a complex system, right, is that let's say we tweak this bit and see what happens. And so where else do you do that? But there's genetic manipulation. So I was looking at labs that were doing genetic manipulations of the heart and then measuring what happens. Turns out there's not a lot of those. But I sent letters and things to everybody I could think of. And I heard back from somebody. So I went out to their lab and I dutifully gave my Ophiid biology lecture to them. And they're like, okay, I don't really know where we're coming from here. But, we talked a little bit about muscle and about some of the work I'd done in skeletal muscle. And they, took a chance and they said, well, we'll hire this guy. And it turns out they were looking for somebody who would help them characterize the phenotype, the physiological phenotype of the MDX mouse, because nobody had really done that before in the heart. And so that was the task I was put on. And so then during my postdoc time, we studied things, membrane sealants. We did some of this AAV work where we put the microdystrophin in, really stressing, pushing on, a variety of little studies that we did to try to understand the situation. And that's sort of kind of kept me going, is really just looking at, all of the things that break when you take this one protein out. One thing that's really struck me is that, we like to pretend that when we do a knockout model that we, understand what that protein does. We don't. Is often there's it's way more complicated, and we certainly see that in the dystrophin phenotypes where they're just everywhere. It may be dystrophin special. It's a special protein that when you break it, it's particularly bad. But I don't know.
Yeah, that's really good insight, I think, because it's definitely not as simple often as we conclude in every paper we write, right? It's always much more complexity. Compared to when you were a postdoc or a graduate student, now as a, leader of a research group, how do you find it's different in how you approach a project? Are there differences in what you see in a project and what you expect out of it that might be quite different than you were like as a postdoc or certainly as a graduate student?
The postdoc lab I was in was really well funded, right? And so it wasn't a question of, should we do this or can we do this, right? We could always do it, right? It was a question, do we want to, that kind of thing. And so we could do everything we wanted. And so that was really nice. But when you get out into the real world and you're kind of like, well, I gotta pay the bills, right? So then you end up having to choose and decide this project versus this project. And it's really hard because you have incomplete information. You just don't know. And so you're like hedging your bets all the time. Like, oh, and so we put a lot into trying to understand, hypoxia spectroscopy and all of that stuff. And, it was kind of like, oh, did we just waste all this time? Well, at a minimum, we showed that hypoxia isn't important, right? So that's something to hang our hats on. But yeah, it's a challenge. I spend a lot more time in this. I'm in my office, and that's where I spend a lot of my time. Writing grants, trying to get papers together, trying to, analyze data, these types of things. And so it's less at the bench, and it's more paperwork and coming up with. Trying to come up with new ideas, trying to come up with new ideas that have support out there that you can maybe do an experiment or two to add to build that preliminary data that the study sections want to see that show that one, you can do this, and two, that you should do, we as a group should do this. And that's part of the challenge of this endeavor. It's one of those things that I don't want to get too political here, but you think about I like to think of cruise missiles in the context of there's about 20 R01s there, right? And so you're making choices. As a country, we make choices. And if we could fund NIH, we could fund NIH to the levels that would allow me to spend more of my time doing science and less of my time trying to convince 30 of my other colleagues to kind of try to parse hairs and put my application slightly ahead of the other amazing applications that are already in their pile. But this is how it is. And so we, as scientists, this is the system we got, and we try our best to do what we can. But yeah, so podcast listeners out there, again, talk to your representative. See if we can't change the situation a little bit. Give us folks in the lab a fighting chance.
Tommy, I wanted to say my buddy Sush Ranadeve, who I think is a repeated AGP Heart contributor, he said as a postdoc, he compared being a postdoc to going to a new professor where you're harder on the same time to be being a rich prince as a postdoc, and then moving towards being a pauper king. And no one has ever said anything truer to me about the transition from postdoc to, you're just like, everything you want as a postdoc is possible. And then you start your own lab, you're like, let's get to work. And they're like, there's no money and no one believes you can do anything. And you're like, wait, what?
That is so true. In fact, we actually when we're looking at trainees and things, we like people who have been poor in a poor lab at some point, because you learn how to fix equipment, right? You learn how to jerry-rig things together. If you are in a rich lab, right, and you can buy, like, you've got this confocal with a service contract and all of that stuff. When something goes wrong, you're like, I don't have to deal with it. I just call the person and the person shows up, right? And then you come to your own lab and you're like, maybe you don't have a confocal, you have an epifluorescence scope, right? And then, something breaks on it and you're like, oh, what do I do, right? But if you had been in a poor lab where you had, oh, when that microscope breaks, you do this thing, right? And you can fix that or fix that, or you're not afraid of taking things apart to look inside and say, oh, I see how that works. I just have to plug this in or replace this fuse or move on, right? And then you can fix your equipment, you can move forward, and you don't have to pay some technician $1,000 to come out and replace a fuse, right? You're like, shoot, I could have done that. But that's I think that's a skill, right? And sometimes our hyper focus on, the elite, right? You fail to recognize that when you come out into the air quotes again, real world, you have to make do. You have to find a way to scrape and, pull things together.
Yeah, I think that's pretty valuable advice for someone like myself who's, right now a rich prince, but soon to be a poor king, probably. So, all right, my final question for you, Duane, is how many drafts of this paper would you say you guys wrote? Again, just to offer perspective on, the process of putting together a paper like this.
Yeah, so this paper, as you read it, there's kind of layers in there, right? And so we were like, we did the functional data first, right? So we knew that there was the figure one, right? That there's a lot of data there. We've done, we did theobutamine, we did hypoxia, function measuring, all these things. And we're like, well, that's interesting, but we still have no idea what's going on, right? And so then we started off on the metabolomic stuff, and we started looking at that, and we're like, well, maybe there's something interesting here, right? And then you go through the metabolomic stuff, and you're like, well, there's really nothing super new and exciting, right? It was all just about, when you make them hypoxic, they're hypoxic, and then they're not hypoxic when every other time, right? And you're like, ah, okay. So, if it had gone the other way, maybe we published that even without the spectroscopy. Spectroscopy becomes another whole paper. But that's not how it played out. We did publish the entire sort of methods of the metabolomic stuff, because we knew that that was going to be way too much to put in with a Langendorf paper as well. And so that paper sort of became a little side shot. So then we were like, well, do we publish this? Are we ready? And then I got talking to Sarah and Matt, and I was like, oh, maybe there's more here. And so we went after the spectroscopy stuff. And then at that point, we're kind of like, I think we're good. And then the last thing we added was that calcium data at the end, trying to kind of get a sense for, what's going on. We kind of knew others had kind of shown that calcium was perhaps something amiss, but really they just shown it as they were blowing up, and it wasn't really necessary about the MPTP. And so we sort of demonstrated that with calcium. And so that sort of put together the paper, and it was kind of a group effort. There's many a couple generations of students on there, trying to sort of do their part, right? And so I had one student who's devoted a ton of time on the spectroscopy bit, right? They had some coding capabilities, and so that was handy. We started in R, and then R was too slow, so we switched to Python, which required us to learn another whole language. That's sort of the endeavor. It's a slog, but yeah.
So, Dwayne, actually, I gotta say, I understood 30, maybe 20% of your paper. But as you explained everything, I found myself understanding much closer to a solid 70 or 80. So it's been amazing listening to you explain your science. And we all wish we were in your classes because you're just truly a spectacular teacher. And the energy you bring is great. This makes me wish we had a video podcast, not so people can see me sitting in a closet, but so that people can see Dwayne's hand gestures and facial expressions. You think his sound effects are good? What's happening on camera is really amazing. So thank you for sharing all this with us. We have a rapid fire question thing at the end. I can never remember what it's called. I think we hop around. I'm going to go with heart to heart today. Heart to heart. Hit me, Dwayne, coffee or tea?
I don't drink either. I'm a water person. Egads, I made it through grad school not drinking coffee, and I'm like, why the hell should I start? And so
Oh.
I drink water and I go to bed early and I wake up early and you get just you get well, I shouldn't say I go to bed late and I wake up early. But that's okay. I manage. Sometimes if I have a grand, I'll get a Coke or something, a little caffeine. I find that if I don't desensitize myself, then it works really well, right? Because I can just take a can of Coke and I'm like up all night, and then they get your grant done.
Wow, absolutely. I wish everyone could have seen our faces. Again, jaws on floor, no coffee or tea. Wow. What show are you watching right now, Dwayne, unless you don't watch shows?
TV? Who's got time for TV? We are fans of it's on Disney Plus. They have these like little Marvel shorts or the Mandalorian shorts. Those are fun. I haven't had one in a while, so I've actually been getting a lot of grant work done, so it's kind of nice. But that's something we do is to it's kind of to do this sci-fi adventure thing.
Love it. Same, same, same. What is the best science social media account that we should all be following?
This is a tough question because there's a lot of different takes on it, right? I'm a big fan of Michael Eisen because, sorry, AJP, but he talks real about publishing and the challenges of publishing, the challenges of evaluating publications and evaluating the people that produce the publications, and really what science should be, could be. Ought to be these types of things, and I find his commentary on sort of science writ large to be really useful just in my thinking of yeah no I can get behind that the whole open access all of that stuff it's really important. He's most well he's often on what do we call it Twitter X whatever it is now. I from a science point of view his brother too has a pretty interesting account, although it's he does bird pictures, which is fun.
I love it. I would both read Twitter posts about publication fees and bird pictures. So I like both of these ideas. That's great. Give a shout out to someone who inspired you as a kid.
I know this is probably a bit cliche. So my dad was a PhD scientist at the University of Minnesota. And so I grew up in Minneapolis and. And he would he let me in the lab. God, can you imagine? I was like a 14-year-old, 15-year-old kid. And he's like, "You come in and wash some dishes." And I was like, "Okay." So I was like in this research lab. I was like, oh, this is so neat, right? And he's just kind of hang around there. And looking back, I was like, I don't think I've ever seen it. A 16-year-old. I mean, I wouldn't even allow it anymore, right? But there I was. I was there. I was able to see kind of what it looked like in the lab space, and to kind of see what it was about. And in high school, we had this independent. So I went to a science and technology magnet here in Minneapolis, and one of the we had a sort of a capstone senior project type of thing. And my dad was like, "Oh, I got this project for you." And he said, we're going to characterize the molecular weight of pheomelanin. Okay, so pheomelanin is like melanin, but kind of orange. And so, we literally took not all my hair. I used to have hair, and now it's all gone. But we would grind it up, and we tried to characterize the molecular weight of this ground up solution mixed up. And so the biggest challenge, at least for me, was paying enough attention to do the standard curve because you had to keep, you were doing gel chromatography. And so we had different molecules of different sizes, and we put them on there, and then we had a little spectrometer that would measure it at the end of. And so it was a little bit tricky, but he like, "Here, you take this." And so we had this material in the school, and I like during class, I'd say, "Oh, excuse me, I have to go and change my buffer." And so I'd run out of class, and I'd go, and then I'd pour the more buffer on the top, because we weren't fancy enough to have like a peristaltic pump or anything. We just had kind of a reservoir over the top of this buffer, this column, and it was a great experience. I was like, this is kind of fun. It was a complete disaster. I mean, we got nothing done. I never characterized the column. I was never able to make sense of the molecular weight. I broke some things trying to solubilize this. And I mean, he was like, "Don't worry about it. The thing is, it's stupid to make glass pedestals out of glass." But then you realize that you're not gonna bake without breaking some eggs, and you sort of appreciated that there are things you can break, and there are things you can't. The difference. And that was, instead of like going into the lab saying, "I can't touch anything, because anything breaks, then I'm in a whole bunch of trouble," right? But if I break a $5 pedestal versus, a $50,000 scale, these are different things. And knowing the difference was something that sort of put me on the path towards trying to make sense of everything. And so, I guess that's what I'll say. I know it's a bit cliche, but it's kind of true. Kind of brought me into this. I would did my undergrad at St. Olaf College, which is kind of a small liberal arts college a little bit south of here. Didn't have a ton of research. I hung around there down in the summer, and eventually I got into a lab, and we did some stuff. But it was really, I knew that that was fun from, my high school experience. And then when I got to vet school, I was like, "Oh, give it a shot." And the rest is history. It's a continuing story. I don't know. I don't want to. Who knows where it's going to go? But that's what got me here.
That's beautiful. I feel like that's not cliche even a little bit that you have a parent that can do that for you. I have to say, my partner is a 7-year-old, and we brought him into the lab, and we have a bod pod in there, and he walked in, he went, "You didn't tell me you had a spaceship in your lab." And he spent like 15 minutes sitting inside the bod pod. And when we had to leave, he was like, "Can I go back in the spaceship?" So the other nice thing about bringing kids into the lab is that you get to see things in a different light. And apparently the bod pod's a spaceship. All right, this is a question from personal experience. Last rapid fire question. What was, and maybe not, maybe your answer to this will be nothing and I'll be jealous, but what was the most recent thing that a young person said or did that made you feel old?
I don't listen to that nonsense, right? So kids will say things, I mean, I have kids. I think probably the thing that made me feel the oldest is that my oldest son just turned 21, right? So there
Oh, wow.
is a quantifiable problem with that, right? Because that means that I'm way older than 21, right? And so, it's not something he said. It's not something, it's just the. We've been on this rock circling this star, and it's been a long time. I'm, as you may have gathered from some of our conversation about shows and whatnot, I tend to not be super engaged with like a lot of the world. And so things that might date me, I was just like never really paying attention anyway. And so, I guess, the time that I say, "You remember Prince?" and someone's like, "What?" then I'll feel old. But that hasn't happened yet.
Thanks so much, Dwayne, for joining us today on Behind the Bench. It was really exciting hearing really just your love of science, and the work that you do is really inspiring. And I'm looking forward to seeing more on this project as it evolves. Obviously, getting ever more complex, I'm sure, but you seem like the guy for the job. So very excited to kind of follow that research as it's unfolding. Yeah, we really appreciate you stopping by and sharing your knowledge with us, and best of luck for your lab this year and moving forward, and hope to have you back on the show again soon.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell.
Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.